Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation about, I say my favorite subject every week. I'm getting sick of hearing myself say that, but it's certainly one of the most important subjects, I think, that we don't always talk about, and that is taste. So for 30 minutes once a week, if you listen on the podcast or you listen to us live, we get to have a really, I think, an interesting conversation. I always feel enlightened afterwards, and I'm someone who spends my life in the food world, so that I hope that you enjoy it too. And today, I'm very excited about the conversation we're going to have, because one of the challenges when you're working on food, and by working in quotes, I mean studying, doing any sort of serious academic work, or even just trying to get a handle on what actually happened in the past, it's very challenging. Food has been so much a part of everyday lives, so much a part of outside serious life, I think, in some ways, celebrations or family gatherings or all the sorts of things, that it's often very difficult to find any real quote unquote facts. I mean, facts in the broadest sense. Think what really happened. What was the history? Not just the stories and the legends and the myths and the things that are passed down, but what was important? What actually happened? And so it's a real pleasure today to have with me in the studio Paul Friedman, who is the Chester D. Tripp Professor of History at Yale University, which is a very serious-sounding place, serious-sounding title, although not a professor of food history, a professor of medieval history, but a serious academic who's, lucky for us, his hobby, his history hobby is food and restaurants and America's love affair with cuisine. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thank you, Mitchell.
It's really, as I said, great to have someone who takes such a serious and enthusiastic look. You are a food and restaurant lover as much as you are a historian of food and restaurant details. And I wanted to talk today about a bunch of things. You're working on a project that we'll get to a little bit later, finding that the sort of writing about the 10... the most influential restaurants in America? Is that how you would describe it?
That's right. The title tentatively is 10 Restaurants That Changed America.
Okay. So 10 Restaurants That Changed America. It sounds ready for a magazine article, because we all like lists, and we'll get to that a little bit. But I want to talk to you first about this idea of doing history of restaurants in America and the challenges and the rewards that presents.
Well, I am, as you said, a medieval historian, and that's what I am. My main job is. I became interested in food history of the Middle Ages, but I'm very interested in America for some of the same reasons as food is interesting to me from past periods, and that is, not only, as you said, what did people actually eat? Mm-hmm. What did they like to eat or prize? And what did they prize as food that had status? So I'm really interested in class and food. What does it mean to eat caviar? What does it mean to eat heritage breeds of pork now? Mm-hmm. Why do certain fads go out of fashion, or fashions go out of fashion? And what is the way in which people think the upper and the lower classes eat, and how does that change? So those are the things mm-hmm. that restaurants are one way of approaching.
And is there a reason you believe that restaurants might be particularly fertile ground for that kind of exploration, the class and status?
Certainly for the high end, mm-hmm. but also for the way the high end sometimes reverses itself and adopts what until recently has been regarded as low end. That's what we're experiencing now. 30 years ago, poor people kept chickens in their backyard, or poor people canned food, made pickles, kept it over the winter, and well-off people ate stuff that was imported, like Scottish shortbread cookies, or Dover sole flown in, or foie gras from a tin can. These items had prestige, and now it's the reverse. It's the poor people who are at least associated with processed food, or not very fresh food, or lack of concern with where the food comes from. And it's well-off people who are frantically figuring out how to raise chickens in their backyard.
I'm sure sitting here in Bushwick, we could probably throw a stone and hit a chicken in a backyard somewhere.
That's right. We're in the eye of the storm.
So let's talk about the process a little bit, because I think people don't always understand the process of history. History isn't storytelling exactly, although stories are part of history. Tell me, how do you find out? How do you engage with this idea of how status and fashions change in food and restaurants? Let's talk about the 19th century, maybe. How do we know?
Some of it is in literature. Mm. So novels like those of Edith Wharton that focus on society will tell you a dinner party in New York in the 1870s had to have terrapin, had to have canvasback ducks, had to start with oysters. These are status foods, and they are the definition of upper class entertainment. Some of it comes from menus. And that was really the first thing that made me fall in love with this subject, was the New York Public Library's collection of menus, which numbers something on the order of 40,000.
Wow.
I think they've now digitized maybe half of those. And these tell you what restaurateurs thought would appeal to their customers. They show you the dishes that are most common, the dishes that are most expensive. They show you the arrival of different trends, like Chinese restaurants whose clientele was not Chinese, or casual lunch restaurants whose clientele was expected to be female. And so you can learn a lot from menus, travel guides, travelers' stories, or actual guidebooks are very good for information about places that were tourist destinations, like New York, obviously, but a lot on New Orleans, for example, which was in a way the first gastro-tourism destination in America. So once you start looking, the material is everywhere. It's a little bit different from what I was used to with researching the Middle Ages, where you have a very large number of archives, but you kind of know what sorts of places will have saved material from the 12th or 13th century. When you're dealing with more modern materials, 19th, 20th, 21st, the opportunities are greater, but it's the same sort of process of thinking about it seriously, asking people, and accident.
So I imagine one of the challenges of finding the archives is that I don't know that the Delmonico's knew at the moment they were making history, let's say, in New York. And so I wonder, did people save things? Or do restaurants, I mean, the restaurants I've worked in and seen the back of houses don't look like natural places for archives. They look like piles of dirty stained papers and that sort of thing. Does that pose a challenge?
If they saved the dirty stained paper, we can figure it out.
We could do DNA testing and know what they really ate. Right?
Some of it depends on the storage space of the restaurant, and a lot depends on the personality. So one of my restaurants in the proposed book is Antoine's in New Orleans, and they have a very extensive collection of materials that they saved in the course of the 20th century. But the other, perhaps the most famous restaurant there, along with Antoine's, Galatoire's, has very little storage space, and so has almost nothing except a few menus that they've framed. A lot of people kept menus as souvenirs, and so they turn up on eBay a lot. There's a collector named Henry Voigt in Wilmington, Delaware, who has what, to my knowledge, is the greatest collection of American menus in private hands. Wow. And he's got a wonderful blog called The American Menu where he discusses them.
Is he generous with access to them?
He's been extremely generous. And as I said, many of them are posted online. So, yes, he's been a wonderful resource in this. And the historical societies, local historical societies of states or of cities often have a lot of menus and reminiscences of dining.
I remember after a recent tour of the collection of menus at the New York Public Library, I came back to my desk and in pencil wrote the date of everything on the back of the piles of menus on my desk, just in case they ended up somewhere to help history be made in the future, because it's so hard to know sometimes.
History will thank you, because one of the frustrating things is having this menu, not having a date, and then trying to figure out on the basis of price. The 19th century, though, is great, because every day restaurants had a different menu. The printing costs presumably were negligible, and they would change their menu every day. So
really?
A menu from the 19th century always says something like January 14th, 1875.
So that's something interesting, because we assume we invented that idea of changing the menu every day yesterday or Friday or something. And I'm wondering, when did that stop? When did we decide that we would fix a menu? Probably had to do with business, some efficiency decision or something.
That's right. I think it comes about in the 1890s. In the 1890s, certainly by the early 20th century, that becomes less common to have them dated day by day. I think it was just assumed for a while that that indicated what they really had. It saved the waiters the obligation of having to say what their specials that day were.
Right, which many a diner today would appreciate.
would, although presumably it also is supposed to convey some excitement.
Right.
And restaurants like it or think that customers appreciate it. And perhaps you and I are not representative enough to say that we don't. But the change is one of efficiency and to some extent of predictability.
Hmm. Predictability.
People want to know from day to day that there will be pizza at Roberta's, that there will be a series of items that they are accustomed to having. And then if a few things change, that's fine. And of course, that was true with many of these restaurant menus. They change every day, but they cycle through a number of dishes.
But that's interesting, because at some point in history, one imagines, let's say, the 40s and 50s, that idea of predictability becomes a virtue that leads in some ways to McDonald's or to this eruption of the sameness that you always hear as one of the beside the food, which was never necessarily the point. This idea that you could walk into a place anywhere and it would be the same became a real value for people.
That's right. On the other hand, from the beginning, there were certain kinds of high-end dishes, or not even necessarily very luxurious dishes, but let's say upper middle level dishes that people expected to have at, say, a hotel restaurant.
What were those?
A lot of the things would be dishes involving mutton, dishes involving game, dishes involving macaroni, strangely enough, which seems to be the most common dish in the restaurants that I looked at from, say, the 1850s,
really?
1860s. I don't know why, and I don't know the differences among all these dishes that are described often in French as macaroni à l'italienne, macaroni à la napolitaine, macaroni à la milanaise. They all seem to involve a rather soupier kind of macaroni and cheese than we're used to.
And one presumes that would be before the mass immigration of Italians that would...
It's the only Italian dish that they've picked up. Otherwise, Italian food is not of any interest to these restaurateurs. Oh. They've picked it up via France, because it's already in French cookbooks, and this is the French interpretation of an Italian dish. Oysters. You would find oysters, of course, everywhere on the East Coast, but to a surprising extent inland as well, because people would go to the trouble of keeping them alive in railroad cars and serving them more or less fresh in places like Chicago or Minneapolis.
And now that's interesting also. I mean, all of this is interesting. That's going to be my most used word in this show. But I remember reading William Grimes' history and his depiction of the corners of oysters were everywhere in downtown New York during certain parts of the 19th century. The oyster bar, he's got some figure of how many there were at a certain time. And yet they were still expected in these places of status, let's say.
Yes, it is. Every society has a few dishes that both rich and poor like and have access to. So oysters were very cheap, available everywhere, certainly in New York. Once you get out as far as Minnesota, then they do become expensive, and they're not the food of working men. But they also were highly prized by the wealthy. I would say in the Middle Ages, for example, chicken and herring are like that. They're food that both the rich and the poor eat, whereas the rich eat spices and the poor are not supposed to. The poor eat things like root vegetables. The rich despise them.
Oh, interesting. There's that word again. Sorry, I'm just going to be amazed with Paul here.
I'm flattered. Thank you.
We're gonna sit and we're going to digest that for a moment and take a brief break. A brief break. We're talking to Paul Friedman. You're listening to Taste Matters, and we're talking about history of restaurants in America.
You're listening to The Crying Blues by the California Honey Drops on heritageradionetwork.org.
Is the only farm in the United States that has its own USDA-inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA-inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high-quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years. A full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and I'm talking with Paul Friedman, who's a professor of medieval history at Yale University, but whose interests in a current project he's working on takes him into the world of restaurants in America and the history thereof. That was an accent that evokes some history and in that commercial we just heard.
It certainly does. I spent 18 years teaching in Nashville, Tennessee, and although Georgia and Tennessee are hardly the same thing, it does bring back some memories.
Sure. So let's get to this project, which I think is going to be much anticipated. The 10 most influential restaurants in the course of American food history. Let's start by talking about how you would make that list. What sorts of influences you were looking to?
Well, I don't quite want to take the position that these are the 10 definitive most influential. I'm going to claim they're very influential and
okay.
That they changed the way Americans dine, or at least that they exemplify trends. So I begin with Delmonico's. Everybody, I think, knows is the first serious restaurant. By serious, I mean having an extensive menu, very professional service, beautiful ambiance, and high prices, established in New York in the 1830s. And I haven't quite decided between the most recent, which will either be French Laundry or Alinea.
Mm-hmm. And bookending those two, so is it a chronological list?
It's roughly chronological, but some of these restaurants, like Howard Johnson, which is the first franchise restaurant, it's a roadside restaurant, it's a restaurant for which many people, at least of a certain age, have lots of memories of. Howard Johnson lasted for 60 years, so it encompasses a fair amount of time. Some of these other restaurants, like Le Pavillon, the definitive French restaurant in New York, dominated the scene, but for only really about 25 years. Mm.
So, and Howard Johnson, of course, whether or not it even resonates with some of the people listening, comes up usually when we talk about Jacques Pepin, because everyone is surprised that, that one of the great food educators of our time was gleefully the chef there. Took that job instead of going to the White House for the Kennedys, the story goes.
I like this because it shows that there isn't a kind of hermetic seal between mass market and prestige, or between mass market and chef-directed projects. Howard Johnson is also really the first franchise restaurant, and the franchise model is what lies behind fast foods. Mm-hmm. People say sometimes, well, why don't you have McDonald's there? Obviously, McDonald's is tremendously influential. In that case, a lot of histories have been written about McDonald's already, and I'm interested in the origins of the franchise model, the origins of the fast food model, not so much the phenomenon at its height.
Right. And so are there the other areas of influence you're looking at?
Yes. So you can't write a history of American dining without considering Italian food and Chinese food, just to take two nationalities among many possible. So the Mandarin is my example of a Chinese restaurant in San Francisco that was an early example of a kind of high-end Chinese restaurant, high-end in the sense of decor and service, as well as the quality of the food served. Early example of northern Chinese food. It's the first place where many people who were not Chinese had pot stickers or hot and sour soup. I have an example of an Italian restaurant, a restaurant Fior d'Italia in San Francisco, which is about 135 years old, and that is influential and exemplary in the sense of representing what it is about Italian food that attracted people who are not necessarily of Italian origin to dine in that particular manner, and from there to others.
Just give me a snippet. What do you think that was? Because from our perspective, my perspective at the James Beard Foundation, I've been there in the last 20 years long enough to see when I started, it was very hard for us to interest people in French food, believe it or not, that anything Italian brought a crowd and anything French was a tough sell. And obviously that was a moment in time in New York City that where things had changed from the histories of those things. And in fact, there's been a little bit of a reverse, although Italian is still beloved. But it's, we think of it as always being beloved, of always being a category of high cuisine, let's say.
Well, I think the two things are different. It's been beloved since the 1890s. So beginning in the 1890s, maybe a little bit before, you have what contemporary sources refer to as bohemians, people who are artists or journalists living in the cities who don't want either the stuffy kind of atmosphere of the fancy society restaurants, but are too aesthetically aware and a little bit too upper class for the working men's grubby kind of cafes. And so Italian food starts to be patronized by non-Italians, 1890s, 1900s, and then it's plentiful, it's delightful, it's served with wine, it has interesting flavors, and the atmosphere is informal but festive. This association of Greenwich Village with Italian food is one that there are still some vestiges of, and this is what attracts people to so-called ethnic foods in the first place. Inexpensive price, interesting atmosphere, a delightful food, but a body of knowledge to master so that you can show off to your friends that you are beyond, say, chop suey and now have moved on to General Tso's chicken, or that you are beyond chicken cacciatore and now insist on vitello tonnato, that kind of one-upsmanship.
Right. Let's move to today. Based on, I mean, you're still in the midst of the research and the writing hasn't even really begun, I imagine, but what do you think's going on now? You are a lover of contemporary restaurants as much as a lover of historic restaurants. What do you see? You've alluded briefly to this change in the high-low. Obviously, the local, the homegrown has become a celebrated and important marker of status. But what else are you seeing out there?
Well, I think the homegrown is a long-lasting phenomenon that changes a lot of things, because what has been preferred in American dining and in a lot of American consumer behavior has tended to be variety, options, rather than intrinsic quality. So that if you offer a bunch of different kinds of yogurt or different kinds of orange juice or different flavors of tortellini, that's more important than whether they're really very well made to start out with. It's kind of a distraction from the fact that many of these foods are not all that well made because they're industrial products. If you're going to emphasize locality and seasonality, then you're really focusing on the quality of the product. So I would say that in long term, that remains the most important phenomenon. Within that, different things come and go. So as you said, I think there's been a return to interest in French cuisine that's long overdue. There is a spreading, a continual rediscovery of different kinds of regions. So it's no longer possible to talk about, at least in fashionable circles, Chinese food. What's important is food from Yunnan or
Shanghaiese.
So people become very sophisticated about that. I can tell you some things I'd like to see, although I don't know whether we're going to see them. As part of the whole hog movement, I'd like to see a return to organ meat, very big in the 19th century. I admit to having some favorites among organ meats. I guess I prefer sweetbreads to heart. But there is some slow movement in that direction. These things taste great. They have interesting textures. They go with a lot of different ingredients. And they're thrifty. You use the whole animal.
And I'll note the sweetbreads here at Roberta's are very special.
I've had them. That's right. I'd like to see an expansion of species in fish. And I think that the questions of sustainability, taste, and variety come to an interesting point with regard to fish. I'd love to see sustainable game. I'd love to see a return to various kinds of venison preparations. There is no great shortage of deer in the United States. So those are just some possibilities.
And well, that's interesting. That's a great list. And I'm wondering, I know historians hate this sort of question, but since they were popular, and how do we lose our taste for them? Because the taste piece I've never quite understood. Even this idea that we came, America's formed from people from other places that had very diverse and rich food cultures, and somehow that went away also. I know we're in the midst of refining them, but do you have any theories about that?
Well, Americans tended to see themselves for much of the 20th century as people who had drive, efficiency, and were not excessively pleasure-oriented. And while food is a necessity, to convert food into a pleasure, particularly to take a lot of time preparing it or eating it, seemed to betray what was best about America. And you see this with regard to social workers visiting immigrants and trying to get them to make steaks and eat cheese and processed bread, because these are healthful, so it was thought, but even more, they're efficient. The idea of immigrants cooking in the morning, cooking all day.
Crazy, what a waste of time.
You enter their apartment, they're always cooking. It's a waste of time. They should either be out working or they should be enjoying healthy leisure, playing tennis, golf.
Funny.
And so this notion then put a premium on simple food, on food that is convenient, and advertisers convinced people that it tasted just as good, if not better, as the food that took more time to prepare.
Well, there you have it. And I love tying that into the pressures that that change put on the environment and on some of the sustainability of some of these species. We're in the midst of having to deal with a lot of the consequences of those changes, which is another reason I think that taste matters, because it isn't just about what we enjoy. It's about, you know, how we set up our world in some ways, these things.
I agree. Unfortunately, one of the less endearing aspects of the 19th century is their willingness just to slaughter birds and fish for the table. So you see all these things like plover or prairie hens or passenger pigeons that are either now extinct or nearly so. Certainly the most prized foods, as I said before, were canvasback ducks and terrapin, neither of which is actually really readily available because of the degradation of their environment and overcatching.
Well, thank you for joining us. Always an interesting conversation.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Next week we're welcoming Diane Kochilas, who is a great author of Greek cookbooks and also a chef and consultant on several Greek restaurants here in New York, but she'll be with us from Athens in the studio. In the meantime, eat a wide variety of game and species of fish and think about how important that has been in our history and it will be in our future. You're listening to Taste Matters. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.